Thank you for tuning into this week's episode of the Rising Laterally podcast. This is Arjun Sachdev.
And this is Jay Ballou. We hope you find something here that offers you new meaning or a fresh perspective.
If you do, we encourage you to give it life.
Be bold.
Experiment.
And most importantly, bring it into the interactions with the people you surround yourself with.
And see what happens.
Today's guest is Dr. Laura Fielding. Dr. Fielding is a clinical psychologist who specializes in mindfulness-based cognitive behavioral therapies. She's an expert in what the field calls third wave CBT treatments, which includes acceptance and commitment therapy and dialectical behavior therapy. These approaches infuse conventional cognitive behavioral therapy with that crucial ingredient of evidence-based mindfulness. Dr. Fielding conducted research at UCLA and Harvard, studying the relationship between health behavior and the psychophysiological effects of stress on cognition and emotion. She's an adjunct professor at Pepperdine University, creator of the Mindful Mastery Program available online, and the author of Mastering Adulthood, Go Beyond Adulting to Become an Emotional Grown-Up. Laura, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. Very excited to be here. I have to make a small correction in my bio. I'm no longer adjunct at Pepperdine since COVID and other life circumstances, but I was up until a couple of years
ago. Got it. Okay. Good to know. Thank you for the clarification. Well, yeah, we talked, speaking of COVID, you know, we have talked before this episode about the unique period of time we're all in. We're a year into the pandemic. Vaccines are starting to become widely available. Life is sort of returning to some semblance of normal. When we were talking, we really decided to make this episode about re-engaging life post-COVID. And as you put it, Laura, I thought this is particularly salient right now. You know, we've all gone through a collective transformation and something major has happened here for all of us. For many of us, it's been a mixed bag. You know, some of us have probably grown in parts of our lives, and in other parts of our lives, we've fallen behind. But one thing that we all have in common is that everyone's coming out of this year with new goals and new intentions. As you outline in the book, though, before we go chasing any vision of the future, the starting point really needs to be getting clear on our values. So how can we think about getting clear on our values and using those as a sort of true north moving forward?
Yeah, it's such an important question. And it also will pivot upon what I define as sort of a continuum of personality development in the book. I talk about how, if you know, certainly there are a broad array of types of personalities, but we all sort of fall along this continuum from an over-regulator to an under-regulator. I use a metaphor of a castle person versus a village person. Yeah. And you want to think about, what kind of a person am I, right? What kind of, do I tend to be the kind of person that maybe keeps things more close at heart and doesn't share as much and doesn't really, maybe tries to just, is more of a distractor and a busy person and doesn't really want to kind of go digging in there, versus our village feelers, who are more connected, feeling, emotional, maybe more creative kind of some people. So for listeners, who, if you're listening, think about which kind of person you tend to be, because the, when we're over-regulated, it also tends to be, we might be very mission goal oriented and driven, but we can lose sight of our values. So back to your question of how can we start thinking about our values, when we're overregulated, we're missing a very important flavor. And I'm going to tell you what that is, to figure out what our values are. Because if you think about it, how do you know what you care about? Values are really what we care deeply about, right? So how do you know what you care deeply about?
On a very sort of basic level, you just feel it. It's a very deep emotion connected with what you care about.
Exactly. Exactly. So if you've overregulated, if you've done a particularly good job, before we began, I mentioned my mother-in-law, who is a Holocaust survivor, and how she's the ultimate, like, that ain't happening. Right. And that was really productive during the Holocaust, right? That got her through adolescence, really, actually an abusive household led to being in the Holocaust for 6 years, being in camps for 6 years, to going to Cuba. Like, it's worked for her, right? But when you're overregulated and you don't need, and you're actually pretty safe, you actually are disconnecting from your deep feelings and emotions. And so you don't really know what you care about. I work with a lot of people who actually have a really hard time saying, I don't know what I care about. I'm doing what my parents taught me to do, or I'm doing what I think other people think I should do, but I don't know what I care deeply about. So when we're starting to connect to our values, if you're an overregulator, that's going to be a difficulty. If you're an underregulator, what tends to happen is you start to think about what you care about, but very, very quickly, up pops all the reasons that's going to be too hard. I'm not going to be able to do it. It's going to be embarrassing. It's going to be anxiety provoking. Right. And so that's why, as we're moving into life again and moving forward, we want to build our self-awareness, right? We want to really become mindful of what's happening in me to lead to that procrastination and those delayed outreaches and movements that we want to be taking. So when we think about values, we want to think about the kind of person we want to be, right? What do I, so we, for listeners and for ourselves, we can think about what do I want to stand for in this post-COVID world, maybe stemming from what I've thought about over the course of the year, what I learned about myself over the course of the year. Just asking yourself, what do you want to stand for in a particular domain, maybe related to work? First, you might, well, actually, I'll say this. A simpler way to go about it is first think about what are the top three areas of your life. Is it school and education? Is it work? Is it family? Is it getting a new home, as we just talked about? Is it, or is it from, we mentioned before when we spoke, for me, it's going to be about my female relationships. I really want to work on building those. So first define the domains and then ask yourself, what kind of person do I want to be? Let go of this. I want other people to be like this thing, because that's not in your control so much, but we can talk about that a little later. How do I want to show up in my life in those domains? That's really what the values question is.
Basically. Mm. Interesting. And how do you think about sort of prioritizing like one area of life over the other? I think we can kind of get out of whack. Certainly now when we're in a really unusual circumstance, people have maybe overweighted one area and underweighted others. And I think people naturally have a tendency to lean into their strengths. So they kind of want to keep running with the thing that's going well and keep avoiding the thing that's not. But how do you think about how just finding balance across our priorities?
Right. Well, absolutely. And so a lot of people will get stuck in how do I, what happens when my values are in conflict? So I want to be an excellent parent, but I have to make money and leave my kids a lot. That's a very, very challenging dilemma that psychologists talk about a lot. And it is a challenge, but that's where simple things like time management and really recognizing. But what you touched on something very important there, that we tend to lean into our strengths. Humans naturally and organically, like all animals, like my beagle puppy, tend to do more of what feels good and less of what feels bad, right? That's basic learning, right? So we've learned new habits over the course of this year, right? We've become a little bit apprehensive about leaving the house, right? Because home felt like our safety place.
Totally, right?
So that's where the self-awareness starts to come in again. And when we do some exercises or when we talk about it moving forward, maybe we could talk about how do I start to really identify what's showing up. So I've recognized that I want to do these new things and I want to be this kind of person moving forward. But I'm also noticed, how do I start noticing, being mindful of the kinds of thoughts, bodily sensations, and emotions that are kind of getting in the way in between idea of what I want and actual behavioral outcome. There's something happening in that space. That's what mindfulness really is.
I was just going to add to that because, you know, people lean into their strengths and you're asking folks to try to gauge like, you know, what do I really love or how do I know what I love? And it's interesting because I feel like people, when you're always chasing or strengthening your strengths, you can also miss out on trends that are occurring around you. So it's just one of those things where, you know, maybe a technique is to actually take some time away from whatever you're doing right now and actually reflect. If you consistently just keep going through the same thing that you're going through right now, you know, you're working all day and you don't really actually have time to reflect. You, in my opinion, I think you miss out on some of the trends. And
wait,
so
tell me what you mean by trends, please.
So things like, you mentioned that you wanted to get closer and have a more stronger relationship with females. Sure. And I think that's important because one trend is away from male dominance towards the divine feminine, whether that's a person or an energy.
It's definitely time.
And I think that's a trend that if you are always in your bubble and if you only think about your strengths all the time, that's a slight one that you might miss. Another one might be like, you know, people always want to put 10,000 hours into what they do as opposed to 10,000 iterations. So like these small trends, you may miss if you don't actually give yourself the space or time to reflect on it.
Yeah, interesting. So I tend to think of things as patterns, but it's interesting. That's another layer that I don't really talk about in my book, but you're exactly right. And missed opportunities, you know, coming from someone who's, you know, a generation or so ahead of you guys, you know, missed opportunities is a real thing. So while I discussed with you guys before we met, right? For me, it was work and romantic, possibly family relationships, right? And like those were the two lanes, right? Mm-hmm. So you're exactly right. You miss the collaborations. You can miss a lot, right? I think that one of the things in the digital age that is challenging for young people is that you're so overwhelmed with information already. That opening up another lane of like, oh, and what else am I missing can cause all kinds of it, more anxiety, like you need more of that, right? So but I agree that it's missed opportunities. They're proverbial and classic examples of this, of the man who works so hard, you know, to bring home the bacon and thinks he's taking care of his family, but he's sort of missed his kids growing up and is missing important cues from his wife, right? There's the woman who's so busy trying to be lovable that she picks the wrong guys who aren't available, that we all engage in these patterns, right? Where we're so trying to maximize what we're good at and avoid whatever we've picked up along the way. And we could talk about historical programming and how that also leads to some of this, what I call automaticity or autopilot. But it's all about getting out of our own way, right? It's about stepping back non-judgmentally and sort of looking at, and the way I outline it is like, this happens to all of us. There's not one of us that's unique in the patterns and the way things come together. There are facts that happen in the world. And then there's this whole thing of emotions, thoughts, bodily sensations, and action tendencies that happen in you. And when you step back and just recognize that this is just human, right? You can sort of let go of some of that judgment and do the effective thing, which is just sort of say, hey, how am I getting in my own way? Where are my blind spots? And how can I just, you know, balance what we call acceptance and change, pushing myself a little bit, accepting that I'm where I am, pushing myself a little bit and accepting where I am.
Yeah. And there's a lot of threads to pull off there. I guess one thing I wanted to zero in on before we go further was the metaphor of the passenger. I really liked the way that you presented that in the book. And I think as you said a moment ago, it's something that's universal for all humans. Our history tends to follow us around, and it's not always obvious the ways that it's influencing our behavior in the present. Can you tell us a little bit about how you conceptualize the passenger and how we can get better at identifying them and quieting them when required?
With absolute pleasure. And first, I give credit where credit is due. This is Stephen Hayes' metaphor that I then elaborated to talk about passengers and the mind-body vehicle. But the original passengers metaphor is from Stephen Hayes, the founder of acceptance and commitment therapy. Cool. And everyone loves that metaphor. So the metaphor basically is that we all start off on the road of life. I say we start off in this mind-body vehicle, this machine that we're living in. And we start off on the road, and we have our good days and birthdays and holidays, and we have our bad days that are scary and more bullied and other things happen. As we're collecting these experiences, we're collecting the thoughts and beliefs about, am I good enough? Am I pretty enough? Am I smart enough? Do people like me? The feelings, the bodily sensations, and this sort of symphony, if you will, of mind, body, physical, emotional feelings that collect as what I call passengers, or what we call passengers, right? So it's like a constellation, really, people don't like, so I had buck teeth when I was a kid. So people, you know, people don't like me. If I try harder, I'll be good enough, you know, and you start to collect this whole internal experience and reactivity, right, to certain triggers on the road of life. So if you're driving along the same road, you and I, the exact same thing can happen, but for me, it's a trigger, and for you, it's not a trigger, or vice versa, right? And that's because we've collected these past experiences that show up. And when we identify them in this sort of physicalized way, right? Oh, that's my I'm stupid passenger, or that's my not good enough passenger, or that's, you know, whatever your passenger is. This is a really useful tool, right? To really consolidate and simplify. Almost, and sometimes I'll have, you know, younger clients draw pictures or come up with something that's symbolic, right? Mm-hmm. To recognize that here's the deal, right? Just like we can't delete your history, we can't get rid of passengers. We get stuck in mental health difficulties and challenges in our life when we spend so much time, we become a workaholic, we do all these behaviors to get rid of that passenger, right?
Right.
The passenger is coming with you, right? Because I can't delete your history. You can add new experiences, right? To buffer the effect. So how do we deal with passengers if we're not going to get rid of them, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So I'd love to ask you guys what, and I'd like to ask people listening, when you're not feeling good about something, or if you can even think about a passenger, it might take a little time to get sort of familiar. Like, think of something that tends to, you know, it's a passenger, by the way, if it happens repeatedly and other people just don't get as upset about it as you do.
Yeah.
So in your own mind, can you think of something that's sort of passengery, that smells and feels kind of passengery for you?
And yeah, for sure. Yeah. Yeah. I'll share. No, I mean, I have,
okay, if you're willing.
I can be kind of like conflict avoidant in some senses where I have to say no to something or push back on something. And I'm thinking it will solicit a major reaction from the other person. And I'm hyper conscious about the way I'm phrasing something or, you know, trying to make sure there are no hurt feelings. And then after the comment is made, there's virtually like no, you know, the other person isn't triggered at all. Like, there wasn't a big deal for them. And I'm thinking right. that there's going to be some like tidal wave, you know, consequence of this pushback. And it's like no big deal. And I'm like, oh my God, I've just, you know, hallucinated myself into thinking that there was something to be nervous about when there really wasn't.
Excellent noticing. That's right. And well, and then of course you beat yourself up afterwards for, right?
So you're sort of,
and none of that's really effective, right? So, the skillful way to know. So then we could talk about this. I could jump into how to skillfully work with that. The first thing to notice is that it's a passenger for you. So now just next time you have a conflict and you have to say no to someone, all you need to go is like, ah, that's my passenger.
Right.
Right. And it already sort of diffuses the hold that, that the passenger has on you. Because what happens over the course of time is we get this deal going with passengers. You stay in the back outside of my awareness and I'll go where I'll do whatever you need me to do to not have to deal with that. Right. We avoid, we distract, we self-soothe, we do anything we can to not feel those feelings. But that goes back to the first thing we're talking about is when we get too good at avoiding, distracting and not feeling our feelings, we start to lose connection with what we care deeply about and our creativity. So the first step is accepting that your passengers are just a normal part of your existence and learning in a way to love your passengers.
Yeah.
Can I add like the feeling around sometimes I have a feeling that sometimes I can't always trust people because like we were talking about this pre-recording. It's like, you'll tell me that you're going to do something and it's either not done or it's not done, quote unquote, up to par. And for me, that's like something that I struggle with. I don't know if this is something that you can help with.
Yes. Okay. So I'm going to be preaching to my own choir on this too. So we were talking before recording about like, so, and then I get labeled with the moniker of perfectionist, right? Right. I guess I am, you know, the funny thing about being a perfectionist is you don't really realize you're a perfectionist. You just, you know, because to you, whatever, for me, whatever I'm doing is still not as perfect as it could be. Right. Maybe other people think I'm a perfectionist. So how do you deal with it? You start by labeling, this is a passenger for me, right? I recognize that I have a complete, I have a different landscape, if you will, or a different map of how this situation's supposed to go.
Right. Right.
And then you also, it's contextual, right? You think about, you know, during COVID, so we were talking about home remodels and things like that and asking people, you know, if you're the contractor. Why am I having to explain you how to do this?
Yeah, right.
We literally had this yesterday with an electrician and hanging curtains before a house guest comes in. And I'm having to explain everyone, well, why don't you go check the fuse box? Well, maybe you need to measure. Like, why am I doing this?
Right, right.
So what should I have done? notice passenger, right? So the first thing is when you notice that it's your thing. And I love the idea, and I talk about this, I think, in chapter 4, about taking responsibility versus blaming the situation, right? So I know this is partially me, right? And so I know that I need to sort of regulate and use my skills to sort of, we're going to walk through, like, what's the 3-step process of self-regulating. And before I use my chapter 11 skills, which is your assertiveness, like, okay, so help me understand what's going on here. What do you need from me? Sometimes you just got to, and sometimes if the person's just not capable, right? The first question in asserting yourself is this person actually capable of doing? Right. And sometimes you hire somebody you think they're supposed to be capable, and that's what messes you up, right? We were talking about this literality. I think, oh, that's your job. That's what you're supposed to
do. Yeah, right.
So the short answer to your question is own your own reaction, right? Step back and then use your assertiveness skills, right, to sort of ask the person for what they're capable of, right? And there's a whole, I'll just jump in because I don't think we have this on the agenda, but I'll just jump in and say that there's basically three steps for asking for what you want. And this will be good for you because you mentioned that you don't ask for things or say no very well. Mm. Validate the other person's perspective. Hey, I know that this is kind of a confusing one, or, hey, I know that you maybe weren't sure that we were on for today, mm-hmm. Whatever. Validate where they might be coming from, right? And then ask specifically and behaviorally for what it is you need. So are you capable of getting the curtains up without me monitoring you? You think you can handle this? Is that all good with you? And then reinforce. That would really take a load off my mind because I have like 20 other things I need to be doing right now.
Right.
And so it's validate, assert, reinforce. VAR is the skill I talk about. Validate, assert. But always remember question number one, is the person capable of giving me what I want? And then there's a series of other questions that are in the book about what's the power differential. So in this case, this is the handyman and the electrician. I think I have a little more power in that relationship, so I can ask for this. This is appropriate to the relationship, right?
Yeah.
So assertiveness is a big part. It's a big part of our effectiveness and our ability to feel sort of empowered in our world. Right. So my work is about helping people feel empowered and be effective in their lives to build the lives they love. Right. As we're talking about going back into the world, a huge part of that is being able to identify when someone's able to give you what you want in your life or meet your needs, and being skillful even in your romantic or in your marriages and things like that too. Right. That step is an important part of your own self-regulation, because if you can't get your needs met from other people, that's just adding a lot of a burden.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I know that we talked about mindfulness earlier, and I'm sure that you can really weave mindfulness in some respect into any of the frameworks that you go through in the book. But can we talk about a little bit about how mindfulness is a useful way of getting comfortable with discomfort? Because a lot of the times when we identify our values and formulate the actions that we need to take to get in line with those values, the actions feel really uncomfortable. They trigger passengers, and that's when people start to withdraw from their intentions. But mindfulness won't erase that discomfort, but it will at least give us enough kind of disidentification with it that we can move forward. Can you talk a little bit about that?
For sure, for sure. And I'm glad you're leading with mindfulness is getting comfortable with discomfort. A lot of people hear mindfulness, for the general public, they think, oh, it's meditation, right? And meditation is the most studied, the most ancient way of building your mindfulness muscle, right? Mindfulness is a way of using your mind, right? It's a cognitive skill, if you will, some people call it. The function of mindfulness in your life is certainly not to get really good at sitting on a cushion, right? It is to get familiar with the tendencies of your mind and your body, right? Oh, so when you're meditating and then, there's noise outside, you can notice your mind get pulled to that and then judging that, and that's not as it should be. And then your body gets tense. And so building your mindfulness muscle in the context of building a life you want is to get really good at noticing what's getting in the way of you doing those things you say you want to do, or those, moving or being the kind of person you say you want to be in a non-judgmental, it's kind of like being your own therapist, right?
Yeah.
In this non-judgmental way where you can kind of go like, I'm noticing that I tend to get so wrapped up. So an example would be, I would just remember in a time once where I asked someone why they weren't doing something, and their immediate default was all the reasons it wasn't going to work. Mm. Right. Oh. And so that clued me into, oh, that's why we're not making progress on this, because that's exactly what happens. And so that, if we do an exercise today, is something I was thinking that we could do as a little experiential practice for listeners.
For sure.
I could jump into it now, or we can.
That'd be great. Yeah.
Okay. Because it's all theory and concept and me going blah, blah, blah. If I'm telling you about it, you really have to feel it in your bones to kind of recognize what's going on with mindfulness. So, I have two ways of going at this. So for listeners or for ourselves, we can either, sort of have a gaze down and, sort of just a contemplative moment as I walk you through something, or if you're listening, you can write this down on a piece of paper. As we do in the book, we have that form called the dashboard form, right?
Yep.
That is like reading the dashboard of your mind, body, vehicle. So I'd like everyone to bring to mind something that you've been wanting to get started on in the post-COVID world, something that, is related to whatever value you identified in whatever domain, right? So first think about the domain you thought about earlier, like what's an important area of your life you want to focus on? And then how do you want to show up? What kind of person do you want to be? Now I'd like you to think about what kinds of stuff does that kind of person do? Right? What kinds of behaviors? And I don't mean I'm supportive or I'm busy. I want you to really think about a specific thing. I'm scheduling meetings. I'm meeting with girlfriends. I'm, whatever those behaviors are. So I'm going to give you like a few seconds to think about that. You can either be jotting it down or thinking about it in your head. Okay. So when you think about those scenarios or those actions of what does a person who values what you are thinking about valuing, what kinds of actions do they take? Now, when you think about yourself taking those actions, let's just visualize yourself. That would be the facts. That would be that first box on the dashboard form that we may put in a link to in the show notes.
Definitely.
If you were doing those things, all right, so visualize yourself doing it, who you'd be doing it with, what does it entail? What are you wearing maybe? How long is it? Think about that whole scene. And as you have that scene in your mind, what's the next thing that shows up? What are the thoughts that show up about that? What is that going to say about, what does that mean? Are you noticing anything like, gosh, that means I got to actually put pants on again? Or does it mean like what comes up for you really? So, and there's some exercises that again, in the show notes, like I have videos that are linked from QR codes in my book that walk you through an exact meditation like this, but just in the essence of time and just going through it quickly, I want you to think about what goes through your mind. What emotions come up? Is there some anxiety and trepidation, maybe some dread that comes up? And how does that feel in your body? So we've gone through what are the thoughts? What are the emotions? What are the bodily sensations, dread, tension, heart palpitations, maybe even? And what is the impulse? What is the impulse to sort of, avoid thinking about this? An impulse can, by the way, be a thought or a behavior, right? You can behaviorally go like, oh, let me just go. I need to get something to eat first. I need to get something to drink first. But this is how we start to become self-aware, right? What is exactly the process between stimulus, I want to take an action, and response, I'm procrastinating. Mm-hmm. What's the workflow, if you will, of your mindfulness system, right? Like there's input, and it goes through this sort of underground, unconscious process of, thoughts, emotions, bodily sensations, and impulse out the other side that go so fast that we miss it. And so hacking into that system with mindfulness allows us to start being more skillful with each piece of that experience, which we'll talk about when we talk about an actual physical skill. So you start with that self-awareness, really building that kind, loving, self-compassionate self-awareness. And then we, on the other side, say, ah, And then, you know, in the book, there's a last form that lets you say, oh, my pattern of these dashboards tends to look like this. Here are the skills I need to override that automaticity. So I'll be more fluid and integrated and less constrained and automatic and reactive, more mm-hmm. responsive and less reactive. Does that make sense? It was a sort of a hybrid exercise there. It was a little experiential, but it was really, I just wanted to sort of slowly walk you through what doing a dashboard would be like.
Absolutely. Yeah. And what came to mind for me was just how often myself and others probably, I would imagine, have intended to do something. And then like 3 months later, they find that it's still not done. So I really like that metaphor of, you know, you have the intention and then somewhere underground between, you know, the past and the present where it hasn't gotten done, there was some passenger at work that kept you from your intention. And, you know, I think it's just amazing how much time can go by with people intending to do things and not doing them. And, you know, all you think about all the days, all the afternoons, all the hours that passed where you were expecting to fill that time with something you wanted to get done, with something that was of value to you, and it just yeah. didn't happen. It's amazing how persistently the mind can prevent, you know, the ourselves, and I guess the mind body vehicle can work against us and keep us from a future we have every intention of crafting.
Well, right. And it's really important to know that so normal. And it could be more than months. It could be a lifetime, right? Mm. It could be a lifetime of avoidance of pain and clinging to pleasure, right? That's what the definition of addiction is, right? And so all of this automaticity is like mini addictions, right? And it's essential to recognize that this is so normal. It's just, if you want to choose to live a conscious life, right, and not an automated one, which is, you know, as Scott Peck said ages ago, the road less traveled, it's not easy, right? It is more effective, though, than, you know, waking up and life is over, right?
Right.
So if you want to choose, and it's much harder, and then there's, you know, you like me said, took the onus of responsibility on yourself. Then there's contextual stuff. There's stuff that's totally out of your control, right? So if you're a white person like me who has the luxury to sit around and think about this stuff and I'm financially secure and I have this and I have food and I have things I need, then, but if you're, hey, how am I going to get food on the table for my kids today? Then maybe you don't have the luxury of sitting around and thinking about this stuff. Or if you've had a history of traumatic experiences, it's going to be even harder because some of those passengers are really, really scary. And then you'll want a therapist or someone, you know, compassionate other person to help you with this stuff. Mm-hmm. It's not easy. It isn't easy. And I always joke with friends, like, I have a hard sell. Like, I tried to make my book as, you know, appealing and lighthearted as possible.
Yeah.
But it's like, hey guys, let's go feel our uncomfortable feelings.
Yeah, right.
It's a hard sell.
Absolutely.
Speaking of that, and in the context of like people that have been at home working during COVID and then they're thinking about reintegrating into society, you know, you had mentioned mindfulness and tendencies. My question is, how often is the feeling of burnout being confused with actually lack of fulfillment?
Oh, that is good. So burnout happens when you're not connected to your values, right? You can certainly have physical, like you've pushed yourself too far. Like that goes back to being so intensely on one lane of your values, right? That you're working too hard, you're parenting too hard, and you've forgot about your self-care, right? So yeah. You could certainly yeah. have that. But I think that when you reconnect to your values, that is actually where your energy comes from. So maybe you are overinvested in too narrow of a lane of your values, because actually when you're connected to, like when I have conversations like this is one of my values. It doesn't matter how bad of a day I'm having. I'm like, okay, let's, now I get wind in my sails again.
Right. Yeah.
But oftentimes when we're feeling overly drained, we forget to reconnect to our values, right? And we forget that can sort of lift us out. But we do need to take care of the machine too.
I think one thread I heard in there too is the idea that, like, if you're really passionate about it and it's deeply connected with your values, you can push yourself beyond the point where a person who was not connected with that same value would be able to push themselves. So you look at like a professional athlete, you know, they push their bodies to incredible levels. And I imagine if the passion wasn't there for football or basketball or whatever the sport is they're playing on an elite level, you know, the average human wouldn't be able to go to those lengths. But, you know, they can play 10, 15 years in the league without burning out because the passion and the values are there.
Yeah, it's what a writer named Csikszentmihalyi, don't ask me how to spell that, it's called Flow. I don't know if you know this book, Flow. It was very popular 20 years ago. Yeah, that you're in that space between just enough challenge to keep you interested, but not so easy that you're kind of bored. And I think for listeners, the important thing to just remember is that you have to set those little baby step goals to find just your range of enough challenge, right? But not too easy that you know you're being too easy on yourself. Mm. Right. And that is how, you know, I think that for the post-COVID world, I was speaking with a friend of mine who has this charitable organization called Depressed Cake Shop. And I was talking to her where, like, finding something, even if it's baking, right? Or finding some things that light you up, give you a little bit of a sense of mastery. Start with baby steps. You have to start with those. You know, we spoke in the pre-interview about the three levels of goal setting, right? Setting an optimal, like what would challenge you most and you can get that done.
Yeah.
Set an optimal, an acceptable, and a pass level. So you don't sort of set yourself up for these pass fails. You have to find ways to hack in to give yourself a little bit of motivation and stay connected to those values, because it's not all just in our heads, right? As psychologists, we tend to just sort of analyze from the shoulders up. We have to really find things that physically light us up a little bit to stay connected and stay moving forward.
Absolutely. Yeah, I feel like so much of life is just being in a positive loop or a negative loop. Like, you look at the difference between someone who's lost everything and someone who is at the height of their game. There's massive disparities in people's functioning, and I feel like that's largely a function of one person cycling down and the other person just cycling up by, like, taking that first step that led to the second step that led to them being able to gain leverage in life and accomplish so much more than the average person. But it's not like that happened overnight. Like, the outsized success, or even just the outsized wellness that people experience that are really fulfilled and happy and healthy, it came from like a lot of little decisions along the way that cycled up.
Exactly. I call it's every pebble on the beach of your life, like every little decision you've made. You know, I spoke a little bit about why I became a psychologist. I haven't spoken about why. So I became a psychologist because when I was young, I watched people making choices that to me was like, that seems like a very bad idea. mostly taking drugs and getting involved with people that they shouldn't be. And in particular, my sister was making those bad choices. And I had the luxury of being the younger sister, and I could go like, but then I became more and more curious, like, what is happening here? Why are some people making these choices under periods of stress where they're drinking alcohol, they're hooking up with the wrong person, they're doing all these things that to me, it seemed pretty clear that you're going to regret that. And that's going to feed back on that. That's going to, in this links into what you said about the people who sort of stumbled down versus keep climbing up.
Yeah.
When I was young, I didn't know anything about mental health or psychology or anything, but I did know that there was something, it seemed to me, that was different in how we cope with stress, right? So I had my kind of stress. Everybody has their kind of stress. And it's like the old Buddhist adage. It's like not what happens to you, but how you mindfully choose to respond to it, right? And some of us have a heavier burden to carry, for sure. But that's what makes an interesting life, right? I've never met one interesting person who said, yeah, I grew up in this really perfect family and everything was super easy for me. This is just not, that's not an interest. Not sorry for all you people who had perfect lives if you exist. but it is choosing and hopefully finding support and that ability to choose, right? To choose to, and then this is, I think, a nice segue if that works for you guys to talk about how to choose skillfully.
Yeah, definitely. Right?
So Yeah, please.
Before we get there, because some of the words you mentioned like are triggering some questions, I think, that are important. So you mentioned feedback, you mentioned, you know, you choose how to respond, and you were about to get into it. Think about the people that have not gone out in over a year. And so naturally, like, okay, let's say you're a single person, you haven't gone out in over a year. Naturally, you really haven't felt or faced rejection. My question to you, and maybe this is something that we can all think about, is like, what do you think is going to happen to these people when they start to go out again and then they face rejection for the first time in over 14 or 15 months? Like, we're talking about reintegration back into society. I think it's
whatever, but it goes to what we were just saying, right? It goes to how, whatever their passengers are, right? And how they choose to take that in, right? So one person might say, okay, that's, you know, so I always say you can't make a basket unless you're willing to miss the hoops sometimes, right? You got to just keep shooting. Mm-hmm.
So, and I'm saying that sometimes for some people, like, the passenger is going to come out of nowhere. Like, they haven't seen this passenger in over a year, and now the passenger is going to reappear.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so that'll happen. And so notice that I'm non-reactive to that, right? So that the most skillful thing would be that'll happen.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Hello, passenger. Oh, you again. All right. Take a seat. We're moving forward. Yeah. Right. Because that is the general kind of mind shift, mind practice, right? That getting out of this. So it's really a fundamental belief system that is being discussed here. That is one belief system is I'm not supposed to be uncomfortable and I can't handle it. Right. I say over and over again in the book that you can handle it, that every time we practice one of these exercises where I have you visualize something crummy, you realize you can handle it. Right when I finished my book, like 2 months after I finished my book, my beloved beagle Emily died. She was 17.
Oh, no. Oh.
Yeah.
That's a long life, fortunately.
Yeah. She was awesome. And we just got a replacement 2 years later. And it was also it was epic. It was so talk about there was a lot. I was using all my skills, and I was definitely noticing, like, when I would if I talk. So my husband was in China. It was a stormy, rainy night. It was like the definition of trauma. The vet had to come and put her to sleep. It was horrific. Every time I talk or think about it, like, I'd feel the trauma response. The eyes would well, the heart would pound, and I was like, okay, I'm going to practice what I preach. I'm going in. I put on one of my own recordings and visualized the whole thing over and over again, because this is what we do for a trauma. So, or what we're calling here mini traumas, passengers, right?
Mm-hmm.
The evidence supported practice for letting go of getting rid of the sticky factor. Right. So for the person who said going out and she has passengers around rejection, right? Yeah. Or she has that she's going to have to work on some of that stickiness, right? That's her work, right? Because we can't fix that. So what I did was I listened to the meditation and over again visualized the moment I put Emily to sleep and watched that whole, like, ugh, heart sinking, eyes. Watch your face is sort of empathizing with me, right? Mm-hmm. But the more you do that, the more it becomes like a rerun TV show. Like, the first time you saw it, it was like, the second time you saw it, the third time you're like, oh, here it comes, right? Yeah. By the end, you're like, oh, good Lord, do we have to do this again?
Yeah, right.
Right? Yeah. And now you're just sort of bored with yourself, right?
Right,
yeah.
So it takes a lot of willingness, what we call willingness, right? This willingness to feel the discomfort, to, like, let it just land. And you're practicing non-reactivity and you're like, there it is.
Yeah.
And that is the long answer to your question of how we practice with these passengers over time, whether it's going back into dating again, and people are going to have other things like, oh, the average person put on like 2 pounds a month, and there's going to be all kinds of coping to be done.
Absolutely.
For sure.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, the transition will definitely require a lot of mindfulness and a lot of skilled thinking. So maybe we can transition back into that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, in the book, it goes through how to figure out what your patterns are, like what using your dashboard to identify your passengers. And once you've sort of built that self-awareness, your job is to be skillful with each piece of the dashboard in a particular way. Because here's what gets confusing is we tend to deal with our inside difficulties the same way we deal with our outside difficulties, and it's completely counterproductive. So something's broken, you fix it or throw it away, you have dirt, you clean it up, but that's not how it works with the inside system, right? We try to not feel our feelings, we tend to trigger a paradox, which gets us into this emotional spiral. And I like to use the following example of physical feelings similar to emotional feelings. Right now, let's try something together.
Cool.
I'd like you to notice that you can feel your butts in the chair.
Yes.
Got it? Got buttness? Yep. Excellent. Okay. Now I'd like you to try with me. And if for those of you sitting at home, if you'd like to try this as well, feel your butt in the chair. And now let's all collectively try. Let's unfeel our butts. Go ahead. I'll wait.
Yeah. Nope, not making any progress.
So this is the irony of it, right? That we try to unfeel our feelings, and we're trying to, just like we try to unfeel our butt, you might even notice that you kind of, now you're more aware of your butt. And then if I told you it's really important that you don't feel your butt, because you're a bad person if you feel your butt. You're weak. If you feel your butt, you're so weak. This is, you're so lame. Now you feel your butt even more, right? Mm, because you're judging that you're a butt feeler.
Right.
That's what we do when we feel anxiety or trepidation, or we didn't do that thing that we're supposed to do. We start judging ourselves. And we know from the research that you want to add a nice activator to your emotion dysregulation system. It's judgment. Judgment's oil on the fire. Mm. So, the very first step in effective emotion regulation is to let go of that judgment. And start by even just, let's just start with labeling the emotion. So we're talking specifically about the emotion and sort of bodily sensation piece of the dashboard here. Your aim is to let go of trying to get rid of it and lean into, you got to name it to tame it, labeling that emotion. So thinking about that forward motion in your values actions that you had earlier. It might be a little anxiety that shows up, or trepidation, or might be usually forward thinking things tend to be anxiety, might be sadness for the year that you lost, or a breakup, whatever the emotion is, you label it. Cool research shows that when you just find the right emotion word, and that means anxious, sad, angry, frustrated, ashamed, an emotion word, not a thought, anything longer than one word is a thought. Mm. When you find that the one that, like, you got it right. Very cool stuff happens in the brain, that the orbital prefrontal cortex lights up and downregulates the amygdala. It's super cool.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's really cool. So label your emotion and then just, I see you there. Okay. You're there, emotion. So you're really just validating your emotion, right? You're honoring it, that it's present and it's allowed to be there, because that allows the emotion to come and do its thing. And let go. But you start pouring the judgment oil and on stuff on it, and it's going to get stuck. Mm-hmm. Right? So step one, validate the emotion. Step two, now you move on to your thoughts, to the thought box. What is the thought that I'm having? This is going to be hard. It's going to be awful. I'm going to suck. People are going to, I'm not going to know what to do. Whatever that thought is, we're going to step back. And so what you do with thoughts is you check them. So validate and then check your thoughts. You check them for accuracy. And you keep them in check. In other words, you just keep your mind present, right? Rather than time traveling to the imagined catastrophic future, sadness in the past, judging, right? Or my favorite, spacing out, just like, I'm out. And then you don't even know why you're upset because you've spaced out from your thoughts, right? Mm. So validate the emotion, then check the thought. So anyone willing to share what the thought was about the future action needed to maintain your values commitment? Is there any worry thoughts you're willing to share?
Well, I was thinking about, like, my future self. I want to be more mindful of actually showing real compassion and real empathy. And I think the reason I'm thinking about this is because I hear these words all the time: show compassion, be kind, show empathy. But I don't know if I or a lot of people know how to actually do that. Right. So how to really be kind, how to really be compassionate, how to really show empathy. We can all sit here and talk about those are three soft skills that we should all have. Mm. But why are we even categorizing these as soft skills? And I just think it's like these terms that are tossed around so frequently now.
Yeah.
that's great. But at the same time, the disconnect personally is like the how-to part of it.
Uh-huh. And I'm a big how-to person, so you're definitely singing my song here. So I want you to first notice that that's the content of your thoughts, but that's kind of a worry thought, like, how am I going to do this? I'm going to focus on the how am I going to do this, and then I'm going to actually answer that question, because
genuinely, right? Like, where if I go into society again and I start to be more empathetic and kind, mm-hmm. like the people that know me from my past, like, will they be like, who is this person? Like, that's the thing that I'm thinking about is how do I genuinely do it?
Okay. All right. So what might be a thing that gets in your way here is that it's a kind of a worry, right? I'm going to answer the question, but first I'm going to deal with what that question is and how it's functioning, right? What we're doing here is we're doing a functional analysis. This dashboard thing is a simple word for a functional analysis of what happens between stimulus, I want to go out in the world, and outcome, I'm eating cupcakes, right? So, so a functional analysis is what we do in like dialectical behavioral therapy. We do a functional analysis to see why someone is engaging in harmful behaviors when they say they actually want to change those behaviors. Or we do a functional analysis for an addict, or like to see what's getting in the way of the change we want to. So that thought seems to be functioning as, I'm not going to get this right. Like, I'm going to screw this up somehow. So we're just going to notice that's just a thought, right? It's not happening right now. And then you can check it for accuracy, right? Like, what's the worst that can happen if you don't authentically show up and you're trying, but it's not totally authentic, or you blow it? What's the worst that can happen?
Nothing really. I mean, for me, Earth is always spinning, so I mean, it's all good.
Yeah. Right. So maybe there's, like, but just for people listening, if anyone noticed, like, when you're starting to have those, like we mentioned earlier, those thoughts like, oh, I'm going to say no to this person and they're going to get mad at me, or you know, like we spoke about earlier, when you're checking your thoughts, you stay anchored in the present moment. Notice it's just thinking, right? Just a thought. And then you find a more balanced thought, right? So if it's an extreme thought, like this is going to go terribly, terribly wrong, right? You can come back to say, mistakes will happen. It's a learning process, right? You find a more in a regulation model, right? Like that we're validating the emotion first, and then we're finding like balanced thoughts, right? Because those thoughts are going to push those emotions around. So we just want to keep those thoughts nice and balanced and not extreme, because our mind tends to go all or none, black or white, super extreme, what the more stress we're under. And when we're doing something new, like reintegrating or, you know, trying to do something new. Mm-hmm. So in the skill model, just to make sure we have it nice and tight here, the validate emotions, check your thoughts for accuracy and keep them in check. I mean, don't let them go amok, come back to the present moment. And finally, then the final thing is taking control in the only place you have control, which is in your actions, right? So in the action category, you continue to move towards the values and the steps you've identified, but you also can practice some self-regulation things. There's some easy breezy, some of my tips that you can do to sort of, if you have anxiety or you're getting upset or burnt out or overwhelmed. One of my very favorites is walking through what I call the willingness window. It's using your body to inform your mind so you can sort of soothe your nervous system a little bit, right? So I'd like everyone to put your both feet flat on the floor, please. Okay, putting your palms up, out, and on your knees. Dropping your shoulders down and letting your belly be soft. So it's palms up and out, shoulders down, belly soft, chest open. And just notice how you feel when you sit like this. Right. This is sending a powerful message. And you can slow your breathing and mix in a little paced breathing, which is a separate exercise where, let's just do this for fun. Let's inhale 3. And exhale 5. Inhale 3. Exhale 5. So what we've done here is we've hacked into our nervous system, right? From a primal evolutionary standpoint, you simply wouldn't sit with your body posture this open if there was a true threat. So you're telling your brain, no threat, I'm good. And when you slow your breath like that, you're literally activating what's called your parasympathetic nervous system and slowing down your sympathetic nervous system, which is like, run away, right? So we've got our skills challenge is always those three steps: validate the emotion, check the thoughts, control the behavior. Use your skills to soothe your nervous system if you're feeling overwhelmed, and stay committed towards your values. That's the sort of three-step process. If I may, I feel like I've been talking for a long time, but do you want me to come back to that question about how does one authentically validate and show compassion, or show compassion and empathy? Yeah, or is that another podcast?
I mean, it could be a whole nother podcast. I just think it's one of those things, again, just in the context of like helping people reintegrate and also not getting caught up in all the buzzwords in society. It's like, yeah, I know to be kind. Like, I know I have to be kind, but okay, how?
Right. And so the how, it's funny because I'm a how person, and I can even feel myself, whenever anyone asks me a question, sometimes I get pulled into the question and I miss the meta message. The meta message was you're anxious about being good enough or something like that, but there's some underlying something of that. However, I just can't help but answer that question still. But because there's not going to be a perfect way, but it does start with, if I'm better at validating my discomfort, I will be much more compassionate and empathic with other people. So this goes back to the castle person in all of us, because we all are sort of a little castle-y, a little villagey, a little overregulated, sometimes a little underregulated. Mm-hmm. But so for me, being a perfectionist, right? I came back to school. I was like, I'm going to learn the psychobiology of emotions, and then I'm going to learn how to tame the snot out of them, right? So I would definitely be a little bit, even though I was super positive, I could be invalidating inadvertently because I didn't really understand what it felt like for the depressed person to not be able to literally get it. Felt like she couldn't get out of bed until I literally couldn't get out of bed. So I have a self-compassion exercise in the book as well that comes from Kristen Neff, who you guys might see if you can get her. She's like the guru of self-compassion practice and studies. And it is really about these three sort of components. It's about being kind with yourself first, right? And she self-compassion is gentle voice tone, body touch, and like a sing-song voice. And those three components just really, you can, you know, take your hands to your chest and just say, okay, there's some sadness there. Okay, I got that. You get better at doing that for yourself, you'll be much better at doing it for other people. The how is put the oxygen mask on yourself first. You know, empathy hurts, right? Empathy, for me to have empathy for someone who's really struggling, I have to really be able to imagine what's going on with them. And I think when I was young, imagining that someone could feel so incapacitated that they couldn't get out of bed was just not, I couldn't even. So one way, if you can't get there, you could say, I don't understand. Help me understand. Tell me. Asking people about their experience and really listening is the best way you can show compassion, validation, and empathy for them. You can't empathize unless you really understand.
Absolutely.
So that's my little how, I think, on that.
That's awesome. You know, we've talked a lot about the amount of time that people are spending inside, and part and parcel of that is the amount of time people are spending on their devices. You know, many of us have spent the last 12 months using our screens as a portal out into the world. And I think maybe it worked for a short amount of time, but a year later, I think we can all appreciate even more deeply than we have in years past that screens are a really poor substitute for the real thing and for actual, you know, interaction. I came across a pretty troubling statistic that going forward, the average US adult is going to spend the equivalent of 44 years of their life staring at screens, which is kind of haunting. But I think, you know, part of the crux of this issue is that for a lot of people, our screens are both an instrument of productivity and an instrument of consumption. And, you know, I think for many of us, that consumptive function is sort of taking over. I was thinking of a metaphor. It's like if you were a lumberjack out in the woods chopping down trees, but your axe, which is like the, you know, the instrument of your productivity, it's a central tool in your work function, also had the ability to stream movies and social media feeds. It's like that would be highly distracting. And I would imagine you would chop down a lot less trees. So, you know, how can we think about using screens productively and integrating them into our lives in a healthy way? Because at the end of the day, for most people, from a work standpoint, they're just not going away.
Yeah, they're not. And it's not an easy solution. I imagine my I noticed my mind saying someday in the future, they'll have an app for that, right? To say, this is this, you know, that you put on your phone that this, that partitions off, like, do you, are you using, and it will tell you, are you, or, you know, and it'll maybe prevent you if you want to set it up. But in the meantime, and this is the problem with having an app for everything. In the meantime, we have to use our mindfulness, right, to sort of find ways to choose other, like, when you can read a 3D book, read a 3D book. When you can meet in person, and that's going to be a challenge for me, is the meeting, getting my butt in the car, driving down the hill, and going for face to face. When you said that the screens are a poor substitute, there's actually some research that shows that therapy works just as well on the screen. But I do think that just like eating synthetic sugar or synthetic processed foods, we think we're eating food, but they're really food substances and they're not really food. I agree with you that we have to touch, feel, and smell the people we're around. So I think it's recognizing when it's going to start with the whole process starts over again. Okay, what are my values around technology, right? How many hours do I want to restrict? Do I want to set some limits up on my phone that I don't use it? And so I imagine where you would say, okay, for every this many Zoom meetings, I'm going to have at least one face-to-face meeting. Setting your own committed actions around that value of more face-to-face time. And recognizing, for each of us, recognizing the consequence of too much screen time. Really asking, like, what is it doing to me? So for one thing we know is sitting's the new smoking. Right.
Yeah.
So sitting is directly related to length of life and heart disease and all kinds of things. But if you can get clear on your own values of what does it mean to me to be the kind of person who doesn't overburden my life with technology, what kind of a, you know, how will that, then you're getting clearer on your own mission statement. I'm going to think about this for myself, actually, when we're done with this. Mm-hmm. So it goes back to the same sort of steps. Identify the value. Then identify the actions and put specifics on it, right? When you're trying to articulate behavior, make sure that they're like visible actions that you can count, that you can measure, right? Because when you say, oh, I want to be less technology, I want to be on tech. Well, what does that mean? What does that literally look like? How many hours per day are acceptable for you?
Right.
So just getting really clear with yourself.
You mentioned therapy. So a quick question there. If people are struggling as they reintegrate into society, how would they know, or how should they know if their issue or the thing that they're really toggling with is severe enough for them to warrant therapy? Like, how can we encourage people to seek more help so that they can get back on track?
Yeah. Well, it's a tough one overall. Therapy is too expensive. It's not widely available enough. There's not good enough services. We're getting better though. I think one of the silver linings of COVID was that the psychology world got more on board with teletherapy. We came up, we strengthened our HIPAA compliance articulation for online therapy, et cetera. The answer to the question about how do you know when you need help is when it's getting in the way of your life. People tend to not realize things are getting in the way of their life until they really are willing to take a hard look at themselves, right? So it's you know, asking a friend, do you think this is getting in the way of my life? A trusted friend. Listening to what people are telling you. When I became interested in psychology in my early 20s and I started devouring self-help books, I remember going through a phase where I was like, okay, this keeps happening. There's a common denominator here.
Yeah.
and until you're willing to do that, right, then you're going to be really stuck. One of my other favorite Lara-isms is you want to get stuck in therapy the rest of your life, keep blaming your parents. So the path to freedom is taking responsibility, right? And that means taking a kind but honest look at yourself and say, maybe I can do a little bit more. But it's hard, right? If you don't have the financial resources to get therapy, if you're not surrounded with people that you trust, it's not easy. That's why I try to put stuff out there and give it away and have talks and as much as I can. So yeah, so you know it's a difficult, it's a problem if it's getting in the way of your life, it's getting in the way of your relationships. I think everyone needs therapy. I mean, I go to therapy. I think everyone should go to therapy. It's like it keeps you clear.
Mm-hmm.
And honest.
Yeah, one of the things that we're trying to do on Rising Laterally is help with reclassification of assumptions and biases, and so that's why I asked that question.
Yes, I was listening to last week's the anthropological one about that was fascinating. Brilliant guy.
Yeah, he's very interesting work. That was Nobody's Normal with Dr. Grinker for anyone that didn't tune in last week. But actually these two episodes will play nicely off of each other for sure.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, even calling it therapy, right? I guess you could call it counseling. But we go to a trainer for our physical body. We go to the doctor if something's not feeling well, but there is this fear of the mind, right? That it's that black box in there. It's that place under the water that we don't want to go. And if we get braver, if we go where angels fear to tread, as they say, and we normalize that as much as possible, then that becomes part of our everyday conversation. When you guys will have a wonderful world to look forward to. Mm-hmm. When Absolutely. There are those kinds of relationships, and then the world really is working authentically together to make the world a better place.
Absolutely. Yeah. And one of the things that I really do appreciate about CBT is that it is very action oriented. And a lot of the advice that you've given over the course of this episode is very practical, and it requires work on the part of the individual to engage those changes and catalyze changes in their life. It's not just like a quick fix or an easy fix. And it's not just talking about what's beleaguering us. It's actually about doing something about it. And, you know, we've talked a lot about Jung and Jungian inner work over the course of Rising Laterally. And I just wanted to share a little anecdote from the renowned Jungian analyst, Marion Woodman, that really stuck with me. She was writing of her clinical work, and she said that she could work with her clients for years. You know, they would open up about their family history. To your point, they would talk a lot about their parents. They would, you know, plunge into the depths of their past traumas and examine the origin of their neurosis from every angle. But she said for most of her clients, when the moment came where they finally had clarity on who they were and what they were doing that was unhealthy and what they needed to do to step out into the world and actualize this version of themselves that they wanted to become, they couldn't do it. Like, that was the very moment that many of her clients actually withdrew from therapy entirely. Wow. So I thought that was kind of a cautionary tale. You know, it's important to examine ourselves and to engage in that exploration, but we also have to be hyper vigilant against our resistance to change.
Yes. I'm so glad you said that, and brave of her as a Jungian therapist to admit that, right? Because usually it ends up being the Jungians and Freudians against the CBTers. And, and the misnomer of CBT is that it's trite and superficial and just gives you some skills, right? But it's the deep part, it's the insight, right? And the self-evaluation that comes first, right? And then we're just habitual beings, right? If you're used to, you know, your toothbrush being on the right side of the sink in the morning and it's suddenly on the left, it's just the difficulty is always in that transition. And so for right now in particular, we've developed a set of habits over the last year and starting to literally, you know, just get in the car, right? Start with you could even start with little things. Just go take a drive, right? So what I recommend to people, and this is sort of at the end of chapter 7, is make a hierarchy. Right? Like if really, really hard is going on a date, right? Then maybe the easiest thing you can do is put your pants on, right? Yeah. Like make a hierarchy of reintegration and then work your way up that hierarchy. And as you get to the higher ones, you're going to be using your skills as the stress starts to get more and more impactful on you. So you'll need to use your validate, check, change.
Yeah, you nailed it there. I think one of the things for reintegration is people shouldn't put pressure on themselves to get it all done or get it all right. Like right away. Like you have to give yourself that, you know, as you said, a hierarchy. And the last thing I'll say is in terms of coping and visualizing and practicing scenes in your head. If you're a millennial, the one thing that happened over the last year is that the gap between millennials in terms of their income grew. So the reason I'm bringing this up is now you have like a whole cohort of people that are millennial rich. They didn't lose their job. They worked in tech and they didn't actually have to spend because everything was closed. On the other hand, you could be a restaurant worker and you lost your job and now you're considered millennial poor. The reason I'm bringing this up is because as we reintegrate, there are going to be people that will show off about where they travel next or how many restaurants they go to. You don't actually have to keep up with them. And I think there's this like practicing the scene in your head, right? Like you don't worry about what that other millennial is doing.
And also I just want to point out one thing, the show off part could be an interpretation, right? So if you're, let's say you get triggered because you're seeing your millennial rich friends, and that's such an important thing to be aware of, right? This bifurcation that's happened, right? So let's say you lost your job and your resources over the course of a year, and a lot of your friends didn't, and you're seeing them on, maybe Instagram's old school now, so you're seeing them on TikTok or whatever, doing their thing. Notice, do a dashboard around that. Okay, saw that Emily's, you know, in freaking, well, they're not going to too many places because a lot of places in Europe are shut down. Right. But let's say they went somewhere, right? Oh, Emily gets to do this and she's showing off is the thought, right? And it makes me feel envy or sadness, right? Or resentment, right? And the impulse is to maybe take her down a few pegs, right? Right, because that's what we do. We feel envy. We're like, just bring that person down. Well, yeah, but look at her. She's got cellulite, something like that. So just so for the person, for both sides, right? For the person who lost their job and is feeling these struggles with envy, use your dashboard skills or your dashboard form to notice what's happening, and then use your skills to regulate yourself in the direction of who you want to be in relationship to these people. And then I would also say, you know what, for people who did great, maybe be a little, keep that in mind, right? Hold some compassion for like, what if this had happened to me? Mm-hmm. Or help me, or ask your friends who've lost their job. Don't avoid them. Go ask them how they're doing. Maybe take them to lunch, right? And say, how can I help? Right. Mm-hmm. That would be lovely if that's in line with your values.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, I think that's a lovely piece to be mindful of for all of us. Right. To check in with, you know, if you're doing great, great. Check in on someone else. If you're not doing great, you know, dashboard around your feelings of social media exposure to other people. And maybe as best you can, if you can, reach out to people for some support.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's great advice. Well, one final question we've been ending all of our episodes with, which you may have heard in the episode with Dr. Grinker, is what do you consider a modern masterpiece, Laura?
Just a book or anything?
It can be anything.
So how modern? My favorite all-time masterpiece was a book called Consilience by E.O. Wilson. Do you know who that is?
No, I haven't heard of that.
E.O. Wilson was a biologist who then integrated all of the social sciences into one consortium of how they all sort of, how the patterns sort of link up. This is one, and my copy is hysterical with like the colorful highlighting and notes and everything when I was just coming back to school. And that was one of the books that just lit me up. Like, I just love looking for the patterns and things.
Interesting. And
yeah. So that would have to be the one that always is my go-to.
Awesome. Yeah, we'll definitely put that in show notes. Well, okay. Your book is called Mastering Adulthood. It does have a companion program online, which we've talked about. I would highly recommend that. You know, the book and the program, I think, were largely designed for young folks mastering the transition to adulthood. But given the fact that we're going through so much change right now, and I think, you know, anyone from ages like 20 to 40 is...
Or all of my older folks' friends are like, where was this book when I was younger?
It's, right. Yeah, it's exactly. It's really salient.
Advice, everybody.
Totally. Yeah. Regardless of what age you're at. And I think particularly helpful right now, given the fact that we're in a time of collective transition, certainly salient for me. So highly recommend you check that out. And we will put the companion online program in our show notes as well. Very useful videos on your website. Very well Wonderful. Done. Laura, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you both. This was a pleasure.
Thanks for being here.
Thanks.
If you enjoyed this episode, you can sign up for the Rising Weekly newsletter sent out each week.
Every Friday, we expand on the episode with insights, recommendations, and more.
You can sign up at risinglaterally.com.
Thank you.